originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, together again in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios and ready to roll for the next hour. JT, I was thinking about something as I was getting ready for the show. You know, we always say that this is the show that trainers listen to, and that's 110% accurate because we have so many trainers that tell us they enjoy listening to these programs to hear the stories of their peers. But we've run into countless owners that have told us that they listen to this show and have oftentimes selected a trainer to send horses to based on the interviews they hear on this program. So we might want to rephrase that and say the show that trainers and owners listen to.
Well, everybody listens to it, not just trainers and owners, but it's nice that the people in our sport take the time to listen and find out about the people they compete against. And a lot of times, you know, you see people's names in the program or in the racing form and you don't really know anything about them. And you say, oh, I love betting on their horses, but you know, everybody wants to know the real Hollywood story, so to speak. So it's cool. It's great that that people enjoy it, and we love doing the program.
Well, we want to make sure we extend a special welcome to everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius Channel 219, XM 206, and, of course, everyone streaming us worldwide and listening to the podcast of this program on our website. That's all at horseracingradio.net. All right, without further ado, tonight's special guest has trained 248 career winners to date. Now, those horses have earned more than $16 million in purses, thanks in large part to several graded stakes winners conditioned both in Canada and here in the United States. The most recent stable star for tonight's guest is a filly by the name of Dixie Moon, who took the Ontario Lassie at Woodbine back on December 3rd, bouncing back from a sixth place finish in the Juvenile Fillies Turf at Del Mar. She is Catherine Day Phillips, and she joins us north of the border from Woodbine. Catherine, welcome. Happy to have you on board.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing your story. You know, when I called you yesterday and asked you to join us on the program, you had mentioned that it's been a bit of a emotional 24 hours for you.
Well, it was really, I was saying emotional. The past 2 weeks have been very a bit up and down, and we had a very difficult race on Saturday in the Sir Barton, where there was a spill, a very bad spill, and our horse was at the scene of the crime, so to speak, and arguably was involved in it or not involved in it. And you know, it was difficult for the owners and for our rider Eureka, who was on the horse, Mr. Haverkamp at the time. And so that sort of rolled forward to Sunday, which is Dixie Moon, who had the same connections, same owner, same jockey, and again a heavy favorite again. And we were, you know, obviously I wouldn't have been surprised had the owners called and said, you know, we've had a great year, let's just call it a day. And but they were brave, and we soldiered on, and she won the race. It was by a whisker, and I tell you, it would have been a heartbreak to have been beaten by a whisker, but she pulled it through. And it was, you know, great. It was, I think everyone was in tears. It was so emotional.
Well, it's always, you know, tough when bad things happen, but that makes the good things that much better. And you know, congratulations to you and the owners for continuing on and getting that victory. It'll make the winter time a little easier to deal with.
It will. It's that's what we always tell ourselves in the tough times, that it's, you know, it's what makes the good times all the much better. And you have to believe that.
Yeah, how difficult, Catherine, can it be for a trainer to have to deal with all the ups and downs? And, you know, we hear this a lot in racing where it's the, you know, the highest highs and the lowest lows. And I think that's 100% accurate. But when you're going through that roller coaster ride with this profession, can it be difficult to persevere through some of those times?
Sure, it's, you know, it's tough. It's, you never really, you know, when things are going well, you just, you can never get too high and never believe that it's, you know, it's always that easy. And, you know, we all know it's not that easy. And, you know, we had a tremendous run this fall where we were, you know, I think we earned 770,000 in about a 2-month period of time, which is, you know, huge purse money. And, you know, it was a big deal. We went to the Breeders' Cup. It was just, everything just came so easy. And, you know, we sort of knew that that couldn't go on, and it didn't. And we had a, you know, a few races where we were beaten with heavy favorites. And, you know, that was pretty, it was tough. But then, it it can't always be good, and you never can get too down either.
Well, it's tougher, too, because you operate kind of a smaller operation. It's not like you've got 300 horses to take your mind off the bad stuff. You know, when you only have a handful of horses and you're hands-on every day, it can take its toll a little bit.
It does, and you always have to look if, you know, something is disappointing in one stall. You have to look at what's bright in the next stall over, or, you know, you always have to keep looking at something to, you know, to look forward to, or to, you know, to stay up, because that's really what it's all about.
Well, Catherine, you've been around this game for a very long time, going back to your mother and your father, your dad, Jim, your mother, Denny, both involved in the game. Your dad, of course, a trainer. Your mom spent some time training as well. Take us back to the beginning. Where did Catherine Day Phillips get her start?
Well, I guess at a very, very early age, I grew up on Sampson Farms, which at the time my father was a show horse rider. He was on the Canadian equestrian team. And Mr. Samuel was his sponsor at the time, who obviously it was Sampson Farms, or morphed into the amazing Sampson Farms in the, you know, 80s. And we grew up, there were, you know, obviously great horses around always. There was the Olympics. There was always something important going on, world championships. It was, I guess the world stage just seemed like it was the place, or the normal place to be. And then my parents actually divorced when I was fairly young. And my father, I would visit him when he went into training, you know, thoroughbreds. I would visit him to Florida in the winter, and loved the horses, loved being involved with the racing a little bit. I remember doing the set list when I was 12 years old for him, and they had lots of horses in training. I remember, you know, doing the bandages at a very early age when they would ship somewhere, and it was just it was sort of a normal thing for me, you know, to be around. Going forward, after university, I rode show horses when I was a teenager and went to university. And after I left the horses for a little while, and I thought my job was to, you know, be in a money broker for a while. So I did that for a year and then really found that I just missed the horses so much. And I came back, and that's when I started training. I took up my trainer's license in 93, the fall of 93. And I had 4 horses, and that was the beginning.
When you start out small like that, what are some of the pitfalls that you encounter?
I think for me, it was always being taken seriously. I'm a very serious individual. I take life very seriously, and I was always, you know, looked at as, you know, Jimmy Day's daughter, or, you know, there was always some reason to discount, you know, me as a trainer, and that's something that I have to contend with always, even to this day. I get, you know, referred to as, you know, the, you know, that trainer. It's nice that you come and work so hard, or, you know, work, you know, do so well. It's not I get dismissed sometimes a little bit, and that's a little bit frustrating. So I think being taken seriously as a trainer is something that I've battled, you know, all my life.
Is part of that because you're a woman and not necessarily because of your relationship with your dad?
I don't know. Possibly being a woman, you know, being maybe educated a little bit more than the average person, having gone to good schools, having gone to private schools, you know, maybe just considered a little bit, you know, not your typical racetracker. You know, probably a little bit of that, perceived to be quote-unquote wealthy as opposed to somebody who's, you know, worked her way up.
Yeah, I know you attended, St. Lawrence University in New York. Take us back through some of those schools that you attended and your educational background, Catherine.
Well, school for me was really something that had to be done. I went to a very good high school. I was a boarder, actually, at Havergal College in Toronto, which is a very, very good girls' school. And I really didn't appreciate at the time the education I was getting. I went to St. Lawrence University because it was I could leave early. At the time, we had grade 13 in Canada, and you could go to grade 12 in the States, or you know, graduate in grade 12 and go to university. So I chose St. Lawrence University because of that, and the fact they had a writing team. So that was a fairly obvious choice. So I went to St. Lawrence for that, and enjoyed school a lot. But really, it was just something to do. I wasn't pursuing anything specific at university.
Did you always kind of know that you were going to get back into the horse business?
No, I would say in when I was 8 years old, in the yearbook it says that I'm going to be a horse trainer when I was asked what I wanted to be. But I would say it wasn't always that clear. I would say I really thought that I was supposed to be in the business world, and that's sort of what led me to be a money broker for, 2 years, and sort of got away from the horses, and I couldn't really even watch the races. I was really I just sort of blocked that completely out. And it wasn't until I started riding again, and then I started riding, racehorses again, and I realized how much I loved it, and it was really what I wanted to be doing. So I feel I came back to it as a choice, not as an expectation of what I thought I should be doing.
When you put out your shingle and had the four horses, did they belong to you or outside clients? How did that go?
Two were my own, and two were my maternal grandmother. I had talked her into, I think I bought one of them from her, and I talked her into sending me the other two. And, she was supportive. I think reluctantly she was probably a little more interested in me finishing school and perhaps getting married and settling down and having a family. But I was a bit stubborn. But she put up with me. She put up with me and was supportive, but I was pretty stubborn.
Yeah, you didn't get married right away. You were training horses several years before you got married. I think your first win came in, what, 94? And you were married in 99 to your now husband, Todd. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
So as you're getting started, and then that first winner comes along in 94, take me back to that day. What was that moment like?
Well, I actually ran our first race at Tampa. And I did my license at Tampa, and in order to validate your license, which wasn't as easy as I was led to believe, that getting licensed in Florida, but you had to start a horse. So I ran a horse that I'd been training on the farm, and if you can imagine, the horse had been on the farm, I think the exercise at Sampson Farms, so I was stabled at Sampson Farms. One of the exercise riders also had a jockey's license, but I think if I look back on it, he probably hadn't ridden a race in a year or two. So he got licensed to ride the horse, and all of this whole, we went down to Tampa to run this horse. The horse had run before with a different trainer as a two-year-old, so it's now three. It arrived in the paddock, and I can't even tell you the pressure I felt. I think everybody was this crazy thing watching, Jimmy Day's daughter saddle this horse. And the horse arrived. The groom had never run a horse. I really don't know that the jockey had ever ridden a race. It was just a complete disaster. And, oh, my God, I had polos on the horse. I mean, I don't even know how the tack and the polos came off and how this horse made it around. But anyhow, it did, and I got my license, and it was fairly embarrassing all around. So when we came to Woodbine, we were maybe a little more prepared when we came up here. And anyhow, Gentleman Artist was the name of the horse, and Sandy Hawley rode him, and it was great. I don't think he won. I think it was maybe third the first time out, and it was still, again, I think my kneecaps were sweating. It was just a very traumatic experience. And then by the second start, everything was fine. We'd all schooled. I'd schooled, and he'd schooled, and we were fine, and he won his race.
That's great. That's a great story.
Oh, my God. You can't imagine these polos there. I'm like, who on earth puts polos on in their first start?
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I actually have a picture hanging on my wall at the house of my first horse, and he's got polos on. It's just a breeze. It's not a race, but he's got polos on, and the polos are literally, bagging down around his ankles because they were brand new, and it didn't even occur to me to wash them before I put them on the horse. But those little things that happen when you first start training, it's just like, oh, you look back on them and they make you cringe, but we seem to get through it. I don't know how.
It was funny.
All right, so I'm going to ask each of you this question. As somebody who has never trained a horse and never worked with a horse around the stables, What are polos? I'm assuming it's some kind of wrap. Or
yeah,
something?
They're bandages.
That, okay.
Yeah, and they're usually like fleece. They're fluffy. They're what polo horses.
Fluffy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, they're fluffy. Put on well, they look fabulous. Put on poorly, they're a
disaster. Yeah, they're kind of a disaster anyway. I finally got away from using them eventually, but you know, Bobby Frankel was influential with me telling me don't use those things. So, those little moments you just never forget them. They seem to haunt you a little bit.
Oh,
do you ever look back on that day and just shake your head in disbelief that happened, and then look ahead to where you are today and just kind of say, how the heck did I ever get here?
Well, I just think when you're at the beginning of a lot of things, you don't really know that you're at the beginning. I know I've done a lot of things that you don't even realize how much you don't even know. And that was particularly one of the days. But it was, it was the beginning, and that's an important step.
Yeah, a super important step. Catherine Day Phillips with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Catherine, fast forward 4 years from your first victory, and in 1998 you saddle your first stakes winner. And I'm correct me if I get the name wrong. Vobiscum? Did I get
Vobiscum.
That right? Vobiscum. All right. Tell me about that day.
Vobiscum was a little homebred by a stallion that my mother had trained, Pax Nobiscum. And he was, he was not meant to be anything, you know, special. He was, you know, the little homebred by our little homebred stallion or our home stallion. And he, I think it was during the Breeders' Cup? Anyhow, he came to hand and did well. He won his first start. We ran him for 16,000. And I remember another trainer called and said, you know, how do you like your horse running today? And I said, well, he can run a little bit. He's okay. And I said, well, why are you running him for 16? You know, the jockey, David Clark said he should be in for 12.5. And I said, well, you know, he's okay. The gates opened and he was gone. I think he won by 10 or 15 lengths. He didn't get claimed, thankfully, but he went on to, he was a nice horse. He won a few starts as a three-year-old, and we went to Detroit, the old Detroit Ladbroke, and he won the Detroit Breeders' Cup Sprint, which was fabulous, but he wasn't Breeders' Cup eligible, so he only, you know, he made half the purse money at the time, but it was a great win, and it was super fun. I went with my brother, and I went together with this horse, and again, it was two little country bumpkins, and on the bigger stage, it was fun.
Is that a bit of a struggle when you're a small stable and deciding whether you're going to run for 12.5 or 16, or where to place the horses, because you only have a few and you're trying to keep them?
It is, and then at the same time, you're trying to win, and I guess we put so much money into each horse, or much money, much effort into each horse, that it's hard to, you know, you don't ever want to see them go, really. Even though you know horses should go, there's so much that goes in. It really is part of your heart goes into them as well, for me anyhow. And so I really hate running and claiming races, but it's part of the game, and it's, you know, it has its uses.
Catherine, at what point did you finally say, yeah, I can do this, I can be good at training racehorses?
I think I try to tell myself that every morning. You know, you always want to, you know, I always want to, you know, be better and do it better and, you know, strive to be better and, you know, have confidence doing what I do. But it's, you know, every day I think you have to remind yourself that it's good and we're going on.
Yeah, it's one of those things. That's one of the best parts, I think, about training horses, is the fact that every day you learn something new. No matter what it could be, you know, a very small thing or something that really can make a change in your operation. But every day there's something that you didn't know yesterday that pops mm-hmm. up, and it's really cool.
For sure, it's really every, and traveling is really neat. I really enjoy, you know, going to different tracks, watching how other trainers, you know, go about their business. Little things that you pick up so much. That's really fun. That was fun about being at the Breeders' Cup and, you know, the different trainers that were around and watching how they, you know, do things. It was quite fascinating.
That's really interesting, Catherine. How closely will you watch other trainers, whether it be at Woodbine or when you're traveling to other tracks?
probably more the, you know, just different tracks, because it's, you know, they just do things differently. You know, even how they do their, you know, their webbings and their, you know, the crossbars, you know, which works better, and, you know, just get different ideas and, you know, try it and see how it works. We were lucky, we were just down the shed row from Baffert's horses, and that was, you know, looked up and there was Arrogate walking towards us. There he was about 10 feet away. It was neat, you know, collected. They were all right there. So it was, you know, it was neat to see how they, you know, how they do things, how they, you know, set their webbings out, how they put their tack on. All of that is interesting.
Yeah, it's neat to hear you say those words and to listen to you talk, because it sounds to me like, first and foremost, you're a fan of the sport of thoroughbred racing and almost a horse trainer second. Is that accurate?
Probably a fan of, I don't know, probably a fan of horses, period. And I love horses. I love, you know, I love watching them develop. I love being part of their development. That's probably really where my passion is.
Yeah, the development thing is always so cool. I mean, especially you get a young horse and they're like a blank canvas, and then it's up to you to put the finishing touches on them. And I think that's one of the most rewarding parts of being a horse trainer.
Yeah, and for sure, I think that's sort of my forte, or my, you know, what I've enjoyed or really grown up the most with, is just, you know, the young horses. You know, they come to us, and usually in the springtime, and, you know, they are a blank canvas. I mean, you know, not even knowing how to go around, you know, the track most of the time. They're not arriving at our barn at, you know, at the half mile. I always say, wouldn't it be nice to have the horses arrive, you know, breezing a half mile, ready to kick on? But it doesn't happen that way with us. We start right from the beginning, you know, right from teaching horses how to get their feet washed from the, you know, just really literally right from raw at the beginning.
Yeah, some trainers prefer that, though, right? As to, like, let's say a guy like Todd Pletcher, who sends his horses to his dad and he gets them ready and then gets them up to like 3/8 or a half and then sends them in. Some trainers like the fact that you're really hands-on with that horse and teaching him the ropes the way you like to do things.
I think there's advantages to both ways, really. I mean, I think it's hard to – I think if you have, you know, 100, 200 horses, you can't do it that way. You need to have them come to you a little more prepared. You know, if you have smaller numbers, then you can do it that way. I'd say, you know, there's pluses to both.
I'm talking with trainer Catherine Day Phillips on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Catherine, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, and maybe even take us all the way back to growing up around your dad's operation. Your dad, a four-time Sovereign Award winner. You talk about watching how other trainers do things when you're on the road. How did your dad go about operating his business?
Well, he ran in a very, very meticulous barn. You know, the rakes and the forks were spray painted red with a yellow stripe. They were, you know, everything was in perfect color and sync. It was, you know, woodbine, that wasn't a common thing. He took, I guess, his show horse, you know, influence into the thoroughbreds, and I don't know if it was always welcome, but it certainly was a, you know, a stamp, you know, around the backstretch. And so I grew up with that, and, you know, when I went out on my own, I think that same, you know, the same expectations I've taken into my barn. You know, it's very neat, very tidy, very, you know, well presented, and it's, you know, it's a good place. It's clean, it's tidy for the horses, it's a nice place for the owners to come into. I think that's really important, and I thought probably I took from Samson and my father.
You mentioned watching or helping your dad lay out a set list at the age of 12, and you think about some of the names that came through your dad's barn and the Samson color bearers like Dance Smartly and Regal Classic, Regal Intention, Sky Classic. Do you remember some of the names that were on those early set lists when you were helping them out?
Well, Dance Smartly was a little bit after me. I left in the fall of 89. But Regal Classic, Regal Intention, all of those guys were there that, you know, when I was young, they were all sort of two-year-olds and then three-year-olds the next year, and, you know, that was exciting. Sky Classic was just a two-year-old at the time, and he was lovely always, but they were very special horses.
Did you have a favorite?
Of course I'm going to go completely blank because you've said that.
I can imagine Sky Classic had to be close to the top.
One of my favorites was a horse called Todd of Rum, who was a pretty black horse with a, you know, big white face, and he he won the Breeder Stakes, and I just thought he was a great horse. And he went on to be a stable pony for, actually Malcolm rode him for years as a stable pony, Malcolm Pierce. But he was a really neat horse. He was probably one of my favorites.
What was it about Samson and their operation back in the day that just made them so successful, Catherine?
I think it was very well organized. I think the horses were very, and I think the horses were well organized. The training was organized, and I think that they constantly strove to upgrade their stock. You know, I think the biggest thing, Mr. Samuel, was, you know, would call out might be not a nice word, but I know that they would, you know, sort of have an imaginary line, and they'd say, okay, everybody below that needs to go out, and, you know, and they constantly were bringing in more horses or new horses or upgrading, and I think that was what really just kept bringing their level up and up, just a constant strive for better horses and improving the herd, so to speak.
Yeah, it's like a sports team getting prospects, and if you keep improving them every year, pretty soon you're going to be the Yankees, you know.
Yeah, no, they did never ever during those days. They, you know, the good horses were never sold, and it was the ones that weren't panning out or whatever the whatever that line was or whatever the number that was deemed to be kept each year. If you were below that, then they would, you know, be dropped into claiming races or they would be sold or whatever. There was nothing was taken for profit at the higher end. That's for sure in the original days.
Were you in attendance for any of the Sovereign Awards that your dad was awarded?
Sovereign Awards, yes. I think probably the most memorable of places to be was when Regal Classic ran in the Derby. I was in the middle of my finals for university at St. Lawrence, and I had, you know, the thought of going down, and then I thought, oh, I'm in finals. How on earth could I ever miss I'll be late or I won't be able to study or whatever it was. And a friend of mine said, now, you know, what are you going to remember in 20 years' time? And the whatever course it was that I test or exam that I had at the time is long forgotten, but I'll never forget walking over for the Derby. So that was a wise decision.
Yeah, good advice.
Yeah, a very special moment indeed. And that walk, one of the greatest walks in all of sports. And you hear Catherine Day Phillips talking about remembering that maybe more than any moment that she's had throughout her career, at least back in the early days anyways. Catherine, we're going to get to a short commercial break. We're going to come back. We're going to continue this visit in the second half of the show. We'll spend some time talking about some of the other outstanding horses that you've had the privilege to be around. So stay with us. We're back. Second half of Trainer Talk is next. It's all Trainer Talk, and it's all right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Fasic Tipton. Make plans now to attend the Fasic Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale February 5th and 6th at the Fasic Tipton Sales Grounds on Newtown Pike in Lexington, Kentucky. And nominations are now being accepted for the 2018 Fasic Tipton Gulfstream Sale, being held at Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida on March 28th. You can nominate to this premier two-year-old in training sale by visiting FasicTipton.com. That's FasicTipton.com. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
Attention horsemen, the 2017 Iowa Stallion Auction takes place December 2nd through the 9th, with all monies raised used to fund three stakes races, which had total purses of nearly $219,000 this year. The auction is the only stallion auction where the donator of the stallion season is eligible to receive a $5,000 per race bonus. All foals born in 2019, regardless of what state they're foaled in, are eligible to nominate. Make your stallion donation now at iowathoroughbred.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Victory for Home in the Million, and it's the Tin Man who strikes the front. Sun River is under pressure. Jambalaya trying to get out. Dr. Dino pressing. Stream Cat, then Dad is spying a gap. The Tin Man leads. The Tin Man's in front. Sun River under pressure. Jambalaya's let loose. The Tin Man.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John Dooley with the call of that 2007 Arlington Million. That was a race you heard with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network. A true privilege to be there to broadcast that race on that afternoon. And Jambalaya, one of several greatest stakes winners trained by Catherine Day Phillips, who is our special guest on Trainer Talk this evening. If you did miss any portion of this show, we do want to remind you that all you have to do is go to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast of this show and all of our shows is available for you to listen to at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes as well. And of course, you can follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter and Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Jude, we will never forget that day in 2007. Robbie Alborado, Jambalaya storming the victory in the Arlington Million. And what an afternoon for us to be part of that, and for Catherine Day Phillips certainly to be part of that.
Yeah, that was a fantastic race and very exciting. And, of course, I didn't know Catherine at that time. But I always root for the lady trainers because my father had a woman trainer in the 50s.
Yep.
So we're all in on that, and I love the fact in thoroughbred racing that the women compete against the men at every level, and I think that really makes our sport unique.
Catherine, how about that afternoon in 2007? Nice little trip down memory lane there.
Gosh, every hair is standing up on the back of my neck. My eyes are watering. My blood pressure, I think, just went through the roof just now. Wow, what an afternoon. It was the Arlington Million, most spectacular, just to be participating even. You know, we walked over with the horse, and I looked at my husband. I was like, wow, you know, we're in the Arlington Million. Like, look who we're competing against. This is insane. it was almost funny. And, you know, then we saddled them, and, you know, then watching the race, and, you know, he started to make a bit of a move. I was like, oh, my gosh, look, he's making a bit of a move. Well, he might be third. Isn't that great? I thought, oh, he might be third. We're screaming like idiots. And I was like, oh, my gosh, never mind, third. Here he comes. And, you know, then he won. It was unbelievable. It was really, it was just hard to even imagine. So it was great to be, you know, there with my husband. And he, you know, the stories behind it are even funnier. We owned the horse ourselves. We bought him for $2,500 at Fasig Tipton. And he was a very good horse, obviously. And but we traveled whenever we went anywhere. We drove him ourselves. So my husband, Todd, he'd go in the truck and trailer with Jambalaya, and he'd go to Saratoga or down to Gulfstream or, in this case, to Arlington Park with Jambalaya. And, you know, we looked after him ourselves and did our thing and ran him, and it's so ironic looking back on it how it all happened.
Wow. Now, wait a minute. You said $2,500 is what you spent on Jambalaya?
Yeah, and it's when we bought him, we were so embarrassed that we paid only $2,500. People asked us how much we spent, and we said $25, and then I said, whatever you do, don't geld him, because we got to make sure his legs are going to stay on when we turned him out, when we brought him home. So don't geld him. We're not wasting the money on gelding. Let's make sure his legs stay on first. Oh, it was, you know, to be honest, we'd seen him. He was a Canadian bred. He was by Langfer, and he was a big, big, very, very immature horse, and it was when the repository had just started. Repository x-rays had just started at Keeneland, and we'd seen him, but I forgot to, you know, have him vetted properly. We were fairly new to Keeneland and this repository business. So anyhow, we forgot about him, and I looked up and I said, there's that, you know, Langford colt that we were supposed to look at, and we forgot to look at the vet report on him. And so we went over to the consigners and we said, can we see the vet report? And they open the page up, and you expect to see not a lot. Well, this entire page was full from top to bottom. And I was like, what on earth is it? I don't even understand what I'm looking at. And the whole page was filled. And I said, look, there's a line that has nothing on it. Todd said, that's a ditto for the line above it, Catherine. Oh, I was like, oh, my God. So anyhow, all of this mayhem is going on, and we were trying to figure it. Next thing you know, the horse is in the ring. And Mark Cassie walked by, and the horse is in the ring, and nobody's bid on the horse. And Todd and I are looking at each other, and we're all looking like fools. And Mark sticks his hand up and just out of the blue. And ends up the hammer goes down, and they look at Mark, and Mark said, looked at us, and he said, if you want him, he's yours. If not, he said, I don't care, I'll take him. He said, so we're like, well, we'll take him. So we took him, and that was that. And then, of course, everyone said, oh, can we buy part of him? I'm like, no. They wanted to buy in for the $2,500 mark. But anyhow, I think in the end it was a mistake. He was supposed to, the reserve hadn't been put in. And so somebody made an error somewhere, and it was to our benefit. But we were able to get him.
What did Mark say later on?
Not a lot. Not a lot. Oh, no. Mark has always been very supportive, and has been a good friend. So, no, he was fine.
Did he follow the career of Jambalaya, considering the backstory to it?
Yeah, everybody did.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, considering the fact that he said, okay, you can have the horse if you want it, I'm wondering if he, at some point said, man, did I make a mistake there?
I'm sure he did, but I think he was, I don't think anybody at the time thought he would be winning the Arlington Million or, doing what he did. It was, he was just a kind of a big, immature Canadian bred.
When did you first get a sense that that was money well spent and you had a horse that could really run?
He was nice as a 2-year-old. He ran once as a 2-year-old. He was third, going 5/8, which he didn't really ever want 5/8, but it was, I guess, we wanted to get a race into him in August, and he ran once. John O'Jones, who was quite instrumental in riding him through it his 3-year-old year, chose to ride another horse because he felt that Jambalaya didn't have enough speed going 5/8, and he was third, and we ended up putting him away for the year. And liked him over the winter and thought that he would be, the previous year we'd had a bit of gold in the Queen's Plate, and Jambalaya we thought would be the replacement, so to speak, for the Triple Crown for us. And he ran once going short, and it was just not good. He was not, did not perform well. And then he ran again going long 2 weeks later maybe, and again it was maybe in the mud. And it was a mess. I mean, he just didn't really perform at all, and I was just devastated. I thought, gosh, I thought this was a nice horse, and what's happened? And we were walking back across the grass, and Jono looked at the grass, and he says, well, Miss Catherine, we must try the turf next. I said, okay. And so at that point, he'd had two bad races, and it didn't make sense to, run him right away again. We needed to regroup, so we went over to the turf and breezed him a few times on the turf, and he was outstanding. The first breeze on the turf was just knocked all of our socks off. It was crazy. It was actually Sean Clancy was there and saw the breeze, and he couldn't believe it. He to this day still talks about the breeze that he was just sat beside another horse and then just opened up 15 lengths on the other horse. And it was a spectacular breeze, and obviously from there we knew we had something special.
Did he want to buy him for a jumper?
Who?
Did Sean want to buy him for a jumper?
Sean always, yeah. No, fast forward, we went to the only time I met Sean after was at the Saranac. We went with Jambalaya, and we're walking into the paddock, and all of a sudden this lunatic on the picnic table is screaming Jambalaya, and it's Sean Clancy. And he was like the biggest fan. It was, of course, very late in the day, late in the season, and he was having a good time. But he was a big fan of Jambalaya.
Two beers in at least.
I think there were a couple of, yeah.
It had to be closing day.
It was a while ago. It was at the end of the meet, so everyone was a little tired, I'm sure.
Lunatic on a picnic table. I like that better than the dreamy one.
Yeah, the dreamy one, it's been replaced
now.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Sure. Lunatic on a picnic table.
It was a Jambalaya. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was hilarious.
Catherine Day Phillips with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Having an awful lot of fun on the program here tonight. Hope you're enjoying it. Catherine, you mentioned the name A Bit of Gold, who was one of your big horses, took you to your very first Breeders' Cup back in 2005. Tell me the story of A Bit of Gold.
A Bit of Gold was bought for a syndicate, which we ended up not being able to fill. there were 9 shares sold of the 10, and we ended up owning 3 of the 9 shares because, you know, nobody else would buy in. And we bought him, which we thought, you know, for what we had been spending on horses was a lot of money. It was $60,000. And he was by Gold Fever, and he was just a rock star from the beginning. He was an outstanding 2-year-old. He won his first start. He won his A Other Than right back. He won the Coronation, which is one of our Canadian classics for 2-year-olds, Canadian breds, and went on and won the plate trial, and then unfortunately was second in the Queen's Plate by just a heartbreak of a race, and then came back and won the Prince of Wales and the Breeder Stakes. And went on to as a 4-year-old and won several stakes as a 4-year-old. He was just a phenomenal horse on the dirt, on the turf, anything. He was outstanding.
What do you remember about that Breeders' Cup in 2005?
I remember how well he looked. It was the most memorable thing. Is for among all those absolutely amazing horses, he was, you know, probably as shiny or healthy or dappled, more dappled than anybody. He looked so amazing. He really looked the part, and he. Unfortunately, he chipped his knee in the race and lost his shoe, and one thing after another happened. It turned out to be a bit of a disaster, and he actually never did run again. But he was a really very special horse, very, very talented. And I don't think I knew at the time how talented he was. And now looking back, you know, what he did was phenomenal.
Yeah, talk about the Canadian Triple Crown and the different surfaces and all that stuff. What kind of horse you need for that? A special one, obviously.
Fast one. Very fast. Very fast. Well, we change, you know, now it's 3 surfaces. You know, with the synthetic at Woodbine, the dirt at Fort Erie for the Prince of Wales, and then back to the turf at 1.5 miles. It's tricky. There's, you know, not many horses could do that. Probably, you know, A Bit of Gold should have done it. That's the bit of the heartbreak of it all.
Yeah, we were there this year, last couple of years, actually, for the Queen's Plate. And, Catherine, I have to tell you, that is one of our favorite events to cover. The pageantry that's associated with big races internationally is second to none. And quite honestly, you don't get that with a lot of the racing here in the United States, even on big days. Tell people a little bit about the Queen's Plate, what it means to Canadian racing, and what they can expect if they do come to the Queen's Plate at Woodbine.
Well, the Queen's Plate has been, it's sort of a pie in the sky for Canadian racing. It's 1.25 miles on the synthetic right now. It's for straight 3-year-olds, Canadian breds, or foaled in Canada. And it's $1 million. It's maybe not the toughest race, but it's just there's so much folklore behind it. It's just a very special race. It's very It's very special.
What's the first Queen's Plate you remember attending?
That would be tricky. I can't remember the first one. Like your first ride. You don't remember your first ride necessarily. I don't know. I think probably the neatest thing about the Queen's Plate for me was I worked on the backstretch for my father, and I lived with my maternal grandmother, and they weren't very friendly. As I mentioned, my parents had been divorced. And my mother's side and my father's side weren't exactly all friends. But the amazing thing is I could, you know, I'd come to the racetrack in the morning and I'd work on, you know, exercise horses and work on the backstretch. And then I would, you know, change and go over and, you know, be in the trustees lounge with my grandmother on the front side. And I just remember thinking how lucky I was to see so many aspects of Woodbine and of, you know, of the Queen's Plate. I saw it from, you know, right from the wash bay and on the back stretch right up to the, you know, top of the turf club. And it was a, you know, pretty unique experience to be able to do that year after year.
Talk about the joys and pitfalls of training out of Woodbine, you know, on a year-round basis, so to speak. I think a lot of people in the United States would love to hear about what it's like to be a trainer at Woodbine. It's kind of a unique situation.
I think we have a long season, which is great. So that means we can be based in one place. And if you're if you have a bit of a family life, it's much, much better. It's much, we're very lucky not to have to change every, 4 to 6 weeks to a different track, to a different city. So that part of it is fabulous. The weather is a challenge. In the springtime, it's really cold, and the summer, it can be really hot. And again, now we're back to the winter, and it's really getting quite cold again. But it's, we've got fabulous facilities. We've got a great turf course. We have a great training turf course. We have a dirt track, a mile dirt track to train on. We have a synthetic track, which, a lot of people can complain about synthetic tracks, but I think we're lucky to have a synthetic track when we deal with the weather that we deal with, the cold and the extremes.
Yeah, very much so.
We need a synthetic track, and certainly on Saturdays when it's pouring rain, I'm grateful to still get our breezes in, which you don't in a dirt track always. So I think it's a great place to be. I feel very fortunate to be here.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. Catherine Day Phillips here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on HRRN. Catherine, we spent some time talking about some of the bigger name horses that have come through your barn, like Jambalaya and A Bit of Gold. But there's one horse we haven't touched on yet, and that is a horse that has to be special to you because it provided you with your very first Greatest Stakes victory in 2000, the Grade 3 Duchess Stakes, and a horse by the name of Heat It Up. Tell me about Heat It Up.
She was neat. She was bought out of, we bought her at the Phasic Tipton sale for $6,000, I think, for, again, not very much money. And she was a lovely, lovely, lovely filly. And that was when, I guess around the time that I had met Todd, and so he was part of her early development, and we went on to, or she went on to be a broodmare for us, and we had, I wouldn't say a great broodmare, we were probably, wasn't a great broodmare, but we had a lot of her babies. And so she was, she was a part of our life for a long time.
You've mentioned your husband, Todd, a few times here over the course of the past 45 minutes or so. Obviously, I mentioned being married back in 99, and, this relationship has just continued to grow both personally and professionally between the two of you. Tell me about that relationship and working together and how it all comes together for you.
Well, I'm really lucky because Todd is very, very supportive of everything. We work together, even though I'm more in the spotlight than he is. I mean, he's right there, beside me, making it possible that I can be at the track for the hours that I'm at. We have two young boys. We've been raising two young boys that are 13 and 15, Blake and Colton, and they're great, great kids. They're fun to be around. We're very, very lucky that we have a really good life together. So I'm very blessed as far as that goes, and Todd being as supportive as he is, there's no way I could do it without him.
Did you meet Todd at the racetrack?
No, Todd was my polo instructor. I decided to take polo lessons, and Todd was my instructor, and he asked me out a few times, and I didn't want to have anything to do with a polo player. And knew that that was not a good thing, and didn't quite appreciate that he was not your typical polo player. But I finally gave in, and we went on our first date, and I think we moved in together about a week later, and we were married a few months later.
Wow!
So it was sort of the beginning of the beginning of a nice thing right from the get go.
So my wife and I work together now as well. So describe what it's like working with your significant other day in and day out.
Well, luckily we're not on top of each other, and that I'm at the racetrack, so I kind of buzz around and do my own thing to some extent. And Todd keeps, we live on a fairly decent sized farm, and so Todd really keeps that going. So even though we're together and talk multiple times during the day, we're not sort of right on top of each other, so to speak.
So it works.
Yeah, I think that's, he has his little area and I've got my little area, and he supports me and I support him.
How about the two boys? Can you see your sons getting involved in racing at some point?
Oh, I hope not. it's good for me, but I don't know that they need to be getting up at 3 o'clock every morning. And, it seems, I don't know. That's a hard one. I keep saying they need to, they're a little more interested in school than I ever was, so I'm thinking that's a good thing.
Do they love the game, though?
They do, actually. They, you know, I'd say Colton, my youngest son, is probably more interested in the horse racing. But I think that Blake is very interested, too, in a quiet way. Colton came to the Breeders' Cup with us. Blake was actually in the school play. He had the lead role in their school play, so he couldn't come to the Breeders' Cup. But Colton came, and I told him from the beginning he could not come. And then the day that we loaded Dixie on the van, it was 6 o'clock at night, and I got home from the track, and I said, you know, he looked at me and he said, "Mom, how did Dixie load?" I was like, whoa, he really is interested. You know, he wasn't just a pipe dream. So anyhow, we flew him. We ended up flying him out to the Breeders' Cup, and he had a great time with us.
And Dixie Moon, you touched on this at the beginning of the show, how this has been somewhat of an emotional couple of weeks for you, but it was emotional when you put Dixie Moon on the van to head back to your farm, Kingsfield Racing. Tell me a little bit about that moment when you were putting her on, and why was that so emotional for you?
I don't know. I was at Haverkamp Mr. Haverkamp and Dixie Moon both, you know, went on together, and I put the shank on Mr. Haverkamp, and I walked him by, and he was, you know, I sort of stopped at Dixie's stall, and he's looking at her, and, you know, she's looking at him, and I'm looking at them, and looking at the grooms, and it was just, we'd been through a lot this, you know, the past, you know, 4 or 5 months, that it was really, you know, that it was, you know, back in June when we did our first interview together, you know, they were, you know, barely thought of them, really, and they had, you know, Mr. Haverkamp had not started yet. Dixie Moon had been breezing well, but she'd never run. And so it was just amazing how much had actually happened. Haverkamp had gone to, you know, Saratoga and had run well, and he'd won a few stake races and had the whole, you know, disastrous spill that he was involved in. And then there was Dixie, who had, you know, run well. She'd won 2 stake races, and she went off to California and came back. And it was just a lot had happened in a short period of time with them, and it just sort of, I guess, hit me all at once.
It's amazing how the horses touch you, you know. It just, people don't understand, and I always take umbrage when people, you know, knock trainers and say they don't care about horses and that kind of thing. It couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the horses really become a part of you and your family, and the same for your employees and your whole team. I mean, it's just, it's all about the horses, really.
It is definitely. I agree. For me it is. It's just they're so special, and watching how they do it and how they develop is just great.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. Talking with Catherine Day Phillips here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Catherine, looking ahead to what might be next for your stable, your operation, what are some of the goals that you've set out for yourself moving forward?
Well, we've got goals to win the Queen's Plate. That has to happen. That Queen's Plate business has to, really would like to win the Queen's Plate. So if it's not going to be, if it's not this year, you know, or this year coming up, then hopefully within the near future. I think just, you know, constantly increasing the quality of our stable. I'd like to have more horses, but keeping the quality, you know, while more horses, I'd like to keep it small enough that I'm still hands-on, and keep the quality, just keep increasing the quality. That's really what my goal is.
I'm taking a page out of the Samson book, huh?
Exactly. Sounded good.
Quality over quantity.
Yeah, no, definitely, you know.
All right, Catherine, so only a couple of minutes left here before we have to wrap up the show. We always like to end by asking trainers to tell us a little something about themselves that maybe people wouldn't otherwise know. And, of course, we spent much of the past hour talking about your life and your career and growing up around horses. But we're going to play a quick little game, and I'm going to ask you 5 questions. It's 5 fast facts to know about Catherine Day Phillips. You'll answer them real quick, and then we'll be done. Sound good?
Okay.
All right, we'll make them easy, too. I'm going to do this. I'll put it on a tee for you. You can knock it out of the park. All right, so your favorite movie would be?
Caddyshack. Mr. Haverkamp.
Good choice.
That's a peach, hon.
Your favorite musical artist?
Favorite musical artist? Oh, God, that's supposed to be quick, isn't it? Ed Sheeran.
Okay. Let's see, your favorite food. You could have anything you want to eat. What's it going to be?
Todd's Pizza. Todd's Homemade Pizza.
I guess that's near Woodbine?
No, my husband, Todd.
Oh, Todd. Oh, that Todd.
Todd's Homemade Pizza. We make pizza every Friday night. Family night pizza night.
You're a little slow, Baron.
That Todd.
The wine goes with it, too. We have a little red wine with the pizza, but yes, they all go together.
Okay, so I've just invited myself and Jude to your house when we come up for Queen's Plate this next year. Your favorite racetrack other than Woodbine would be?
Saratoga. Arlington Park, though, was very special.
All right. And let's see, last one. Favorite flavor of ice cream. Let's go with that one.
Favorite flavor of ice cream. That's a toss-up between cookie dough, or Haagen-Dazs definitely only, cookie dough, chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, and mint chocolate chip Baskin-Robbins.
Wow, a girl after my own heart. My two favorite flavors as well. Awesome. Catherine Day Phillips, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, will be stopping by in July for some homemade pizza from Todd. We'll have a little cookie dough for dessert. I've already got the menu laid and red wine. Sounds great, Catherine.
Red wine to follow.
Catherine, we really do appreciate the visit. Been a lot of fun. If folks missed any portion of this, all they have to do is go to our website, horseracingradio.net. They can get a podcast of this program and all of our shows, and they can listen at their leisure at horseracingradio.net. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us here tonight, and good luck moving forward, Catherine.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, always a delight. Catherine Day Phillips here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Wow, so much fun, huh?
Yeah, that was great. That was great. She's a fantastic person and just runs a beautiful operation.
So. And you were so right about the emotional attachment with trainers to their horses. And when you said, quite oftentimes we hear people say that, you know, the horses aren't treated well or trainers don't really care about the horses. It's just kind of a meat market type of thing. And they're running them through just to make the money and get them on the track. All that kind of stuff couldn't be any further from the truth.
Yeah. No, it really, I mean, by and large, there's always, you know, going to be people that take advantage but by and large, day in, day out, I mean, that's all people on the racetrack care about is their horses. That's the number one thing. And, when you read that stuff, just know it's not true.
What's the best thing about being a horse trainer, JT?
Oh, I think being up early in the morning. It's like you know something other people don't know. So many people lose the morning time, and that's a horrible thing, I think. The sunrise is beautiful every day.
Yeah, well, it certainly is. And Catherine Day Phillips has seen so many of those in her storied career, and again, great visit here tonight. I want to thank Catherine one more time for taking the time to be with us here. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, simply head to our website. It's all there at horseracingradio.net. Follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.